All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight we're going to uncork a good one for you, like a fine wine. We're going to be talking about Red Obsession, which came out, I think, about a decade ago. And it's a pretty interesting documentary. And this is a suggestion by our friend John Reed, who will be joining us in just a few moments to be our guest during the last night's portion of the show. And before we say hello and introduce him, let's say hello to Robert on this episode 252 of this here show. How are things going over there on the east side?
What's up, dude and dudettes? How's it going, everybody? This is my new setup, and this is going to be the way going forward. I'm going to have these white cans on my earballs. And Daniel assures me that my audio is juicy and fat and delicious. So get used to this. Enjoy it. Hate it. Doesn't matter.
Right now, I notice that you've named yourself Chinese Counterfeiter, probably related to the movie itself, but perhaps also to the white cans you've got on your head. I'm sure that those are a knockoff brand of some sort, but they seem to be very effective, quite good. Maybe all counterfeiting isn't all bad.
Even the movie seems to admit that counterfeiting is a good thing for the French wine.
Oh, okay. That'll be an interesting discussion point. I was wondering what we were going to talk about on this one, because there are some interesting supply and demand price situations that sort of belie the traditional thinking process. And so I want to explore that a bit. I'm a little bit muddled on my thinking on that. So I'm really looking forward to the discussion we're going to have tonight.
Yes, should be a good one. I wouldn't have otherwise done a movie. I don't even know if it's a movie. It's a info doc sort of about this particular time in French wine history. It's quite specific.
Yep.
But I think anybody who has any interest in food, wine, or economics is going to find something out of this one.
Right. And I think that's why I got recommended. And I think I do qualify it as a movie simply because we got to be entertained with the great Russell Crowe being the narrator there.
Yeah, I think he might have literally phoned it in over the course of about a half hour, read a script, and cashed his check. I think he was happy.
Yeah, I think he needed to have those sweet white cans, and then it might have worked out a little bit better. But yeah, it's still pretty good. Anyway, we're going to introduce John Reed right after this on the Last Nighters portion of the show. Stay tuned. Everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson. We are the Last Nighters. You can find us at lastnighters.com. And this is episode 195 of the show. And you can find the show notes more at lastnighters.com/195. We do a little bit of pre-show and post-show bonus content that you can get via our Patreon. And that is found at lastnighters.com/Patreon. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Red Obsession, which is a biopic film. I think that's what, Robert, you were calling it in the some of the pre-show stuff there. It's a bit of a documentary, bit of a talking head thing. It has Russell Crowe doing some narration, and should be a very interesting and fun discussion with our guest, who has been on with us a number of times. And for whatever reason, if it's got Red in the title or something along those lines, he wants to do a movie about it. We had him on for Reds, starring his namesake, or with Warren Beatty as his namesake, John Reed. He is Jonathan Reed, and he has a new project called Wine with Barbecue, and we will get him on screen, main screen now. John Reed, welcome back to the show. That's a very fine wine you've got. It looks like a 82. What's
Lafitte?
Lafitte, an 82 Lafitte, nothing less, nothing less.
You know, it's only like $4,000 a bottle. Pick it up.
Actually, a $12 bottle Chateau Saint Jean from California. So.
All right, so it's not a Bordeaux, because that is based on a very specific piece of land in France bestowed with Napoleonic honor, right? And so there's a bit of a history to that, and the this movie gets into that, which I thought was kind of cool. And we see the name Rothschild in here, so that might be a talking point, perhaps. But why don't you remind people, or introduce to people, what is the new project? And I have a little crawler that I can play along the bottom that they can see while you talk about it.
Yeah, so during the pandemic, I got a lot of free time. I mean, I was still working, but I got a lot of free time. I was really interested in smoking barbecue, smoking meat. I had a smoker. It was a propane, but it kind of quit on me. So I got a charcoal smoker, and that kind of changed my whole perspective on smoking meat and the art of barbecue. And I just started barbecuing every weekend, every chance I could. If it was raining that weekend, I had a visceral reaction that I was really disappointed. And then my soon to be wife, said to me, you should just do a blog because you love wine, you love barbecue, you love pairing wine with barbecue. So why not do something like that? So now I had the brilliant idea of starting a blog called Wine with Barbecue, where I showcase a certain barbecue dish that I cook every so often, or I try to do it every week. It's been a little busy with the wedding planning lately, but I try to do at least one a week. So it's just me cooking my whatever protein I'm doing, and then picking a good wine that I think will go with it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but that's all part of the journey of both barbecue and wine education that I'm proudly going through.
All right, very good. And that can be found at winewithbarbecue.com. We've got that as a little crawler down along the bottom here. And I understand that you also went on a smoking excursion, a bit of a Al-Qaeda training camp, boot camp, for learning how to do the smoking with a pretty famous guy. Do you also consider yourself a bit of a wine aficionado, sort of like how you're a film aficionado?
Well, I've been into wine seriously for about, I'd say, 14 years. So I luckily have a resource very close to me. This woman who I've gotten friendly with owns a wine shop a little far from where I am, but we love the shop so much that we go there, and we go there for the classes that she offers. And we've just learned a lot about wine, just going up several times a year to her classes. And it's been a really fun experience. She's really passionate about it. You could tell, like, if I could trade places with her, I would in a second, because she's really doing what she loves, what she's passionate about. So it really, through osmosis, that passion really gets to, though she's got just a very loyal following, and everybody who just gets an education just by being around her.
All right. Yeah, that sounds really cool. Now, I happen to have a fine wine with me here, so I want to get your professional opinion on this. This is not an 82 Lafite or even a 2009, 2010 that went on the really high, as the movie goes into, like, almost a tulip bubble mania. But you simply pop out this little disc here, and then this nipple comes out, and then you can pour it straight in to a glass, and it's ready to go. I gotta fish it out of here. But I figured, since we're talking about high quality wines, why not bust out this new guy with the nipple? And it's even got a little safety seal on it. And there we go. So we're just gonna we're gonna try it out. And look at that. Can you hear that? That's a sign of a quality wine.
It sounds high quality.
It just oozes right out like a donkey piss at a ball game, you know, where you're holding it till the seventh inning, and then you run to the bathrooms, and there you go.
Now we're joking, but actually, I have had a few boxed wines that have been really, really decent, and one is a rosé, one is a white wine, and they're actually not that bad if you're just planning on sitting out in the deck during the summer and just sipping. Not that bad, but reds in a box are a little iffy for me. But whites and rosés, I think you're not the white Zinfandels. If you're getting a white Zinfandel, I don't really want to associate with you, but
you're out of my hopium community.
Yeah, exactly. But
all right.
Do you know how to swirl and sniff and taste? You know how to taste?
Well, Robert just swirled his camera position. There we go. So I've already put too much in to do it properly, but I got to get a nose of it.
Yeah. What do you get on the nose?
Yeah. We're doing a wine tasting here instead of the show. Actually, this is quite nice. I'm really enjoying myself.
You're getting your money's worth, people.
Oh yes. Yeah. This is a free education. I mean, there are classes you can take that you have to pay good money for to get this type of quality information. But anyway, that's
Spartier by the end of this.
That's right. Well, this is my little nerdy bit to throw in here. So the box wine. Also, my kids, we got some boxes from Costco, and they built little homes out of them in the living room, and they decorated them and wrote on them like private property, entry only upon asking or permission, something along those lines. So they wanted me to mention that because they always have something for me to mention, and I always forget. So. Kids,
do they know
theft? They do. Well, they know taxation theft. They know private property is the way of civilized society.
Oh no! Oh, actual anarchy. I thought this was an ANCOM show. I'm sorry.
Oh right. Since we're talking about something red. Yeah. All right. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Well, speaking of red obsession, let's pull up that Google description, which is how we start off here. So I'm going to add it to the stream on screen and engage. And we'll get underway. We're going to uncork a good one tonight. So this is Red Obsession. Came out in 2013. It got a 6.7 out of 10 on IMDb, 86% on Rotten Tomatoes, 68% on Metacritic, and 77% of the Google users like it. The description reads, for centuries, Bordeaux has assumed a mythical status in the world of fine wine. Chinese demand for France's finest wines has caused the price of Bordeaux to skyrocket, forcing traditional buyers out. It's released in 2013 on August 16th in Hong Kong, directed by Warwick Ross and narrated by Russell Crowe. And after watching this, I thought, oh, I wonder what has happened in the intervening years since, because it seemed to be just skyrocketing price-wise. And they also talked about the financial crisis in the United States impacting wine sales in the U.S. market, and thus that brought in a space for the Chinese market. And then it kind of goes a little bit into the Robert Chinese counterfeit territory after that. But Robert, why don't we get your opening salvo? Why don't you uncork for us a fine wine?
I will attempt to do my best in my most pretentious sommelier behavior. So the film starts off almost like one of those informational videos, like from the 50s, about this is how we make wine. This is how we farm corn.
Wow.
Check out the combine. Thank you, Daniel. Yes. Red Obsession. Then they start interviewing these chateau owners. And it turns into an almost information, like an infomercial level of advertising for French wine. It really goes into the, you get a sense of each chateau owner is a salesman at heart and how much marketing is required for their industry, because each one starts talking about, oh, you just got to connect with your soul to this wine. It's on another level. Like normal people, they don't understand how incredible this product is. And yeah, I get it. Wine is, you know, fermented fruit juice and it's delicious.
Magically delicious.
It is. It can be. It could be terrible. It could be delicious based on your particular tastes. But the level of bullshit that is surrounding the sommelier and the high-end wine market is so delicious. It's really is just the level of pretentiousness and elitism is on another level. And I lost pretty much all respect for any wine grower watching this film, but I did enjoy the, the movie starts off just like really, really boring and bland, and it's not really telling me much of a story, but then it starts talking about history and it starts talking about the Chinese markets and how like you were saying, the U.S. financial crash kind of lost the U.S. market for these wines. So then there's all this Chinese money because of the rise of China and how they've kind of opened up their markets. And that became far more interesting to me. It actually got into a bit of a drama. And like you, I wondered what happened after this film. I haven't looked it up. So I don't know, maybe one of you two have or knows what's happened in the intervening years. But it started to actually hold my attention. And yeah, this, I still don't think that, I mean, I came off of this movie really appreciating the Chinese entrepreneurs and having a big serious distaste for the Napoleon granted the God letter that allows us to be this specific special wine and all you other lesser peoples can only make, you know, piddly peon wine. Screw that. The Chinese entrepreneurs were like, we're going to do it. We're going to work our asses off and we're going to make a better wine. And they did. And screw you, you fancy snooty French fucks, because we're going to kick your asses, not only in how to make a better wine, but also in the marketplace. We're going to make a shitload of wine. You guys are limited to this tiny little amount of wine you can make because you've only got so much space and you can only grow so many grapes. But we've got all this huge amount of country and we're just going to dominate and suck it. That's what I got from this movie. And it ended really, really well. I ended up enjoying it quite a bit.
All right. Freedom fries. All right. Yeah. That's a good opening rant. So, John Reed, let's get you in on this. Let's get your opening salvo and your take on some of Robert's commentary.
Yeah, well, I think the the boring part that he referenced in the beginning, and I think I didn't really keep time on it, but I think it felt like they went in at least 20 minutes on the history of Bordeaux and why Bordeaux is so special, as far as, like, you know, he referenced Napoleon. Really paved the way for ranking Bordeaux in the Grand Cru. I mean, I've had plenty of Bordeaux's. None of them have been, you know, astronomically priced as they are. There are a lot of reasonably priced Bordeaux's, especially for someone with my budget. But I think that was an important step in establishing, okay, you have this traditional kind of high-end wine market that a lot of people really highly regard as you know, the pinnacle of wine examples, or wine, the high bar of wine. And then you have people, kind of like smash cut to another country where the people have been oppressed for so long. They've been living in poverty for so long. And then suddenly in the late 80s and 90s, they come into an enormous amount of wealth. And that's one of the notes I wrote here, is that, you know, it's amazing how much, it's an example of how much wealth can just transform a country and transform a people and what they value and that sort of thing. Whereas, you know, in the 1960s, the Chinese were just begging not to starve. They were just praying every day not to starve. And now you have a dildo manufacturer who's got this immense wine collection, and he's got this enormous expendable income. And it's just amazing that the kind of luxury that wealth can bring. And it's just something that I know we're getting into, kind of like the politics of it, that the communists, the socialists, they just don't understand how important wealth is in establishing the kind of lifestyle that they kind of dream of, that we can have it all and we can all live like kings if only we would just tax the rich and if every worker just owned the means of production. Like, we're talking about a country that embraced more capitalist ideals, and as a result, you know, they're buying fucking the most expensive wines in the world, and they're building collections off them. And it's really an amazing transformation for a country that was just on the brink of genocide and starvation until Mao Zedong just thankfully, mercifully, shuffled off this mortal coil.
Yeah, that's a very interesting take. And I thought that this kind of blends both of your guys' commentary, in that we see these Chinese entrepreneurs, they're almost more capitalist than you see present time in the United States. And I also think that you bring up a good point, John, in that when they had this newfound wealth, these people had been oppressed for so long. They also had a culture of status and honor and giving gifts to others. We see this in a lot of Asian cultures. And that was almost like a perfect storm for this Bordeaux to have this kind of elite status and the status symbolism to it, to where people would only go for a particular brand, buy it as a gift to others to build their own status. And that was a real driving force in the ever-increasing prices that we were seeing in this. And they had that really brilliant marketing gimmick where the 2008 Olympics came into play. And the number 8 apparently is a symbolic for luck. And so it became the perfect gift to give to another person who you were honoring with a gift.
Yeah. And it also is interesting how the Chinese came out of, like, there are still people alive today who lived through the Cultural Revolution, more so back when this movie was made and more so back in like the 90s, of course, but how those people came out having absolutely nothing. And the movie makes this point. And so that creates them like very tolerable to risk. Like, they're like, well, what's the worst that could happen? I could go back to having nothing. Yeah, we did that. We did that for like 30 years. We survived it. It's not great, but we can go back to that. So we're just going to lay it all out on the line and go for it. And that is a fantastic entrepreneurial attitude to have when you are doing something that, you know, never done before. That these people went from basically an agrarian society during the Cultural Revolution. You were farming mostly, and then you've industrialized massively in the past 30, 40, 50 years. It's something new that's happened in their lifetimes. Everything. They've created everything. I mean, the world buys Chinese products, and they're not necessarily bad products anymore. They used to be crap. They can be some of the best products in the world.
Yeah. Now I wonder how much of it is due to state planning with a certain degree of individual decision-making. I'm a little bit fuzzy on it. I know they did lean further into capitalist endeavors and thinking, but still hold on to the socialist roots. But it does seem to have been at least effective in making stuff and making stuff of higher quality and improving the lives of your average Chinese person as a result, especially the ones who are in positions of power, the ones that were bestowed with the government. What's the right word I'm looking for? But the ones that were basically like tapped to you're going to lead this industry, and so you're going to gain on an individual level as a result of this government grant of privilege that they've given to you.
Yeah, well, there seems to be like a capitalist streak going through China in the last however many years, 30 or 40 years. The success is very much tied in the government. I mean, we throw the word fascist around very loosely these days, but I don't know how else to describe it, in the sense that, you know, you're allowed to be very successful in China, but there is a very strong understanding that you're not going to be there's never going to be like a Chinese Koch brothers who really believes in liberty and donates their yen or what yuan to some libertarian Chinese organization in that nation. So it's very much understood that you can be successful. Like, you saw the guy who makes the dolls, you saw the guy who makes the dildos. They're living the life of Riley. I mean, they're living, I envy them so much. But it's an understanding that, like, okay, well, you're going to have your success, but you're going to pay your tribute, and you're never going to, kind of draw color outside the lines, as it were, politically. You're never going to speak against the regime. You're never going to talk against the Communist Party. And, you know, it's a very desirable position for many people, not just in China, but whatever country where you can have that kind of status. It's really attractive.
Yeah, and it's more for just sort of the chosen few. Granted, because it's such high vast numbers of people, it still is, even though it's a small percentage, it's still enough people to create a luxury market for goods like this.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, I think a lot of these people built their wealth from real honest hard work, honest entrepreneurship, taking advantage, like seeing the opportunities that, you know, when Nixon came over to China and established that kind of relationship where it was easier to do business with American companies, a lot of them seized that opportunity and seized or saw the way to better prosperity through people who already had a lot of wealth and had a lot of capital. So I think as the more of those kind of people that established themselves and became more successful, the Chinese kind of, you know, took them aside and said, "Hey, you're doing pretty well. And, you know, it's a good thing you're doing well. We're allowing you to do well. And it'd be a shame if you ever spoke out against the CCP or anything like that." You know, this is just me kind of speculating, but I can't believe that there's a reason we're not hearing about more rich Chinese dissidents who really understand the blessings of liberty and the blessings of capitalism, why they're not speaking out against the CCP. I mean, hell, we have John Cena and NBA players apologizing for making completely innocent remarks about Taiwan and China. You can almost imagine what kind of pressure those business owners over in China are actually under.
Right. Yeah. I know that Jack Ma is famous for being a very, very rich Chinese person. I think he started Alibaba or ran Alibaba. And it's a bit fuzzy, but I know there were recent stories about things happening to him. He had gone missing perhaps for a while. And I think you're right in that they have this social credit system to where if you do speak out against the party, you lose privileges and you lose the ability to do things in everyday life, which sounds almost like something that's happening in present time, almost worldwide at the moment, or attempted to be implemented anyway.
At least in New York City and Los Angeles.
Right. And
in test markets, yes. They're rolling it out in test markets.
Coming soon to a theater near you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to get into a bit more of the history of the Bordeaux region, because it also plays into the pricing that they were talking about, where there was a perfect blend of the type of soil and climate and how much wind and rain and sun they get in a given year that translates into the quality of the wine and the yield that year. And when the things are all just right, which only happens like every decade or two, though it seems like they lucked out in 2009, 2010 in the movie, which seems a little suspect to me. But when those elements are all going well, that would increase the yield, right? As well as the quality, which in a supply and demand scenario would mean that there's more supply for this product. So that would be a downward pressure on the price. But then they found the new Chinese market, which had insatiable demand, which would put demand pressure on it to raise the price. And I think that was one of the key things. And then they were also withholding certain amounts of a vintage, because they still have the 82. They still have, you know, they have like in the cellars, they have their old vintages from years past, and they only parcel them out in very small amounts. And it really feels like there's this weird mechanism by which it's not solely a price, supply and demand price, but there's also like a gatekeeper price where they're only going to sell a certain amount of it, no matter the cost, no matter what someone's willing to pay, they will only allocate a certain amount because they want to save it for the future when it might be more valuable. So it's almost like this investment speculation type scenario, or they want to make sure it's still available at some level. Like they don't want to ever sell out completely of the 82, right? Because the 82 is a very famous vintage that was really, really good. And it might affect them negatively, maybe in a marketing aspect, if all the 82s were gone. But so it took me a while to like try to understand the nuances of how this works, because in traditional, you know, Austrian economics, it seems, you know, a little bit more fundamentally simple. So John, do you have any, or Robert, do you have a specific take on that? And we'll go to John.
Well, there's definitely that element of the chateau owners holding back stock and not wanting to sell out of any particular vintage, which I seemed very much like a speculator type thing, where they wanted to always have some available, but not always sell it, creating this air of exclusivity. Like, if I approve of you, maybe I'll sell it to you. Maybe. We'll see. And maybe I can sell you a bottle or two. Maybe. But if you're a really, really good friend of mine, maybe I can find another bottle somehow. It seemed like that kind of a deal. But the thing that I found the most interesting with the pricing was, and they didn't go into detail. I would appreciate it if it was more detail oriented in the film. But they said that the pricing was directly linked to the critics' evaluation of the crop or the vintage. And that seemed really, really weird. Like, as far as I know, it's the only industry that operates this way. Like, as if, you know, imagine if in the movie industry, a movie comes out and all the critics watch it, and based on their evaluation was how much the ticket cost to watch the film. That would be interesting, but bizarre. Like, here's this piece of shit film. It costs a penny, or it's free, whatever. We don't care. But here's this Oscar winner that we know it's going to win an Oscar, and that's going to be $50. I don't think that pricing structure would work too well in the movie industry, but it seems to work really well in the wine industry. But I mean, at least with the wine industry, you have actual scarcity. You don't have artificial scarcity like withholding a movie. Whereas once a movie gets out there, you know, it can get copied and shared or whatever. An infinite number of people could watch it an infinite number of times once it's released. But with wine, you've got a certain amount of bottles, and based on what the critics say, you are going to base your price of that vintage for everybody. And that just, it seems weird, because you could easily, like the movie says, price out your entire customer base based on the opinion of some critics, or you could sell out every bottle and make hardly any money at all based on same critics. And it also allows for all kinds of sneaky shenanigans with the critics, much in the way that what Moody's evaluated stocks and bonds and like options and whatnots with the financial crash of 2007, 2008. Like, oh yeah, this is AAA rated. Don't worry about it. AAA, it's totally safe. You could just, money in the bank, baby. Just buy, spend all your money. Don't worry about it. I mean, obviously, there's a certain amount of bullshit that goes into wine. Like, I don't know. Maybe I don't have a refined palate, and maybe you need to have drink so much and then really to taste the differences. And it's a really high skill cap. Maybe it is, maybe I don't know. Maybe I just don't have it. I'm just a peon, have no appreciation for it. Or maybe it is just all marketing, and that, you know, the Lafitte's have, Rothschilds have made a fantastic job of doing that, and therefore creating a massive demand for their particular brand, when maybe the quality level between one Bordeaux and another isn't that much different, but the price level for that is much, much higher because of the demand. And I am totally fine with that. Totally fine. And I'm totally fine with this weird system too. It seems to be completely voluntary, but it just seems like it's just a weird way of doing things. You'd think you'd just put the wine out and then maybe a small amount and see how well it sells. And then maybe I'm just ignorant of the way the wine industry works. Maybe you can't, maybe you need to have some sort of a grading system in order to set prices. But obviously there's so much, like the movie also goes into the secondary markets and how much trading goes on in the secondary markets. So there was an entire company that just dealt in trading wine of older vintages as investments or whatever. Mm-hmm. And those prices were completely free market created, like supply and demand. So I don't know. I don't have a real strong take on anything immoral going on or anything like that. It just struck me as odd. I don't know. Did it strike you as odd, Daniel or John, or is this totally normal in the wine industry? It seems to me that everybody else in the wine industry just puts their product out and then prices it as they think it'll sell. And then either it does sell or it doesn't, but maybe that doesn't work when you get to the super high echelon in the snooty fruit juice fermenting business.
Yeah, they've also got they've almost had four or five different pricing systems in place all simultaneously working together in concert to come up with the final purchase price that someone's going to pay. You know, so you've got when there were ration tickets in World War II, if you were a cute girl, you'd get the meat. But if you were just a Joe Blow with the ration ticket, you wouldn't get it. So certain levels of other factors would come into play into how much somebody was willing or someone would have to pay for something or get something at all. And then you've also got almost the taxi medallion status of the Napoleonic bestowing that royalty decree on it. And then you've also got the potentially corruptible system of critics rating it, and they're rating each one individually, but then they talk about the entire year, that year's crop of the entire region being either good or bad. And so there's an incentive for the critics to sort of trend upward as the, you know, the price would be better. But then certain ones, certain chateaus would be more exclusive or better than others. So yeah, there's just so many different factors that kind of go into this. And then you've got that collateralization of everything that seemed to be the rage in the 2000s and thereafter. So I don't know how much of that, you mentioned that's free market, the speculation on that. I mean, maybe, but that's also driven a lot by monetary inflation, where the money has to go into something, investable goods or rare commodities and artwork and things like that are often a place where that kind of that amount of money can go as a bit of a hedge, I guess, against inflationary pressures.
Sure.
Anyway, I've sort of talked a bunch of nonsense there. Let's get John in on your take on this pricing and the several different ways it seems to be arrived at.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in what both of you said there. Well, first of all, I do think there's a lot of bullshit in wine. And I think the bullshit ties into what the Austrians came up, revolutionized as far as the subjective theory of value, in the sense that, you know, it's like diamonds and water. You know, water is obviously much more valuable than diamonds as far as life-sustaining abilities. But when you get to a point in society where you have plenty of water, then diamonds become, because they're so rare, become that much more valuable. And I think it's the same thing with wine here. Because Bordeaux is historically, for hundreds if not thousands of years, been such a highly regarded style of wine, that, you know, once a society like the Chinese get this vast amount of wealth, you know, they start looking for the big status symbols, the kind of symbols that say, you know, hey, I've made it, I've got money. It's kind of like if somebody wins the lottery and they've got now $100 million in the bank, they start buying apartments and decorating them in all gold, like a la Donald Trump and his Manhattan apartments. It's very much in that sense. And I think it has a lot to do with, you know, first of all, I have to say that, you know, wine as a store of value is very much like gold. You know, the gentleman at the beginning of the film who was talking about how a lot of his clients buy wine because they speculate that it's going to increase in value over time. Well, you know, that's the same thing as if you buy silver or gold or crypto at a low price because you think it's going to gain value over time. It's the same thing here. The thing about wine is that eventually it's going to peak at one point, like the 82s that are so prevalent in this film. They're going to peak at some point, and then they're going to ultimately decline and turn into vinegar, basically. So it's all a matter of that status, kind of holding on to something for a little while. Although some of the people who were buying up all those, they didn't seem to have a real plan as far as when they were going to let go of those wines or whether they were going to drink them at a certain point. I'm sure they drink some of them, but that collection was so vast. Like the one behind Daniel there is an example. I mean, that guy's never going to drink that many wines, even if he started like, you know, yesterday. He's never going to drink that many bottles of wine. So it's kind of a moot point, you know. And as far as subjective value goes, you know, I've drunk enough wine that, you know, I know the difference between, you know, the $20 bottle of California Pinot Noir that you get in your local wine store and the $80 or $90 or $100 bottle of Burgundy you get from, you know, a specialty shop. You know, there is a difference in the wine. There is a discernible kind of quality that you get that you know is from someone who really cares about the winemaking process. Not people in California, you know, some of the best Pinot Noirs I've had recently are from Oregon or from the Willamette Valley. So again, it's really all subjective, but there is definitely a quality that's different with Burgundies. And I'm sure, you know, I haven't drunk a lot of like high-end Bordeaux's, but I think there is definitely a quality in wine that you would find, like the difference between a Hyundai and a Mercedes in the car world, you know, that sort of thing. So while subjective value does play a part in here, I think there is something really concrete about, you know, what kind of wine that the Chinese in this film particularly were targeting. Although once the bad vintages happened, once the hail came, once the colder air came in and kind of ruined the one vintage, you saw that subjective value just plummet like that. And the bubble that they talked about, which is a bubble, but is it an artificial bubble? Is there just a real like market bubble in the sense that you're not getting a inflated credit inflation here? You're getting like a speculative value that you're speculating what a wine is going to be worth, but then like the future vintages, if they're not up to par, you're not going to invest as much in them. So it's I think it really is the free market at work, and I think it is the difference between an artificially bank created bubble and a free market created bubble, where people just realize, oh hey, maybe that wine isn't worth as much as it was when I bought it 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. And I also think that when the Chinese market sort of opened up and it was this sort of new market discovering this, there was a lot of demand that was discovered there. And so that's going to have an upward pressure on price. The other angle I was thinking about was each year is a different vintage and has varying qualities. They said that the last good one was 82. And over the course of the decades since, they had been selling that 82 over time, diminishing that supply. And I would assume that would make the price of the 82 keep going up and up as the supply went down. And then they hit 2009 and they finally get another good year, good vintage. And that gets everyone excited. They get all these really high scores and they start opening up the Chinese market because the U.S. market is slowing down due to the financial crisis. But wouldn't then the 2010 being as good of a vintage as 2009 roughly double the available supply of good vintage? Like for a long time, you just had the 82 and then you had 20 years of mediocre, lesser vintages. So the 82 really stood out. Then you get 2009 come along and then 2010 right on top of that. I wonder if it's just, even though you've effectively doubled the supply of these highly rated vintages, that was counteracted by the increased demand that we saw from China. So even though the supply is doubled, the demand outstrips that significantly enough to where we see that pricing increase. And then we have 2011 come along and the hail and the bad weather and the vintage isn't very good. And this is where Robert comes in. The Chinese people have recognized, hey, this wine stuff, this Lafite stuff, people are clamoring for this. We can make our own. And so then they start their own wineries and they've gone to France and they've trained and seen how it operates. And they've tried to replicate the conditions and the soil and basically recreate their own. And this isn't even like the counterfeit side. This is just the Chinese government getting people in levels of expertise to be able to try to recreate this product. And then there's also people finding empty bottles of Lafite and putting putting my box wine in it, which is another layer of counterfeiting that's going on in this. So I just spurted out a bunch of stuff. I thought there was a question or two in there, and then I just kept going. But Robert, why don't you pick up what I'm putting down and take us to the races?
Sure. Yeah. So I thought it was interesting how it seems to be pretty much in every market where there's high-end whatever, like Louis Vuitton bags or any kind of fashionable item that is valuable enough to get counterfeited, there's a certain number of the manufacturers who just hate it and they will fight it. And then there's some that go, oh, that's nice. Yeah, we've made it. Yeah, cool. We're so awesome that people want to imitate us and pretend to be us. And right, I thought it was interesting.
There's one Chateau that said that, right? He was like sort of impressed.
Yeah,
by
he
it,
was like
also saddened by it.
Yeah, he was flattered to a certain extent. And he even the ones that fight it recognize that it's futile to really find the people and to take out the big boss, as they put it. Like you could go to China and find a counterfeit bottle, but actually tracing it back to the source and eradicating it is really a kind of a fool's errand. I thought it was interesting how in China, it's a very much a cultural thing. At least that's how the movie explained it, and why that there's such rampant counterfeiting coming from China. Not that they just manufacture all kinds of goods and they have zero moral qualms about slapping their Louis Vuitton sticker on the bag they just made, but that it's actually a form of flattery and that they recognize like it's an homage to
like an honorable like thing.
Right. It's an honorable, like they recognize the greatness of this artist and this is their imitation of that as an honorific. And that they talked about how it even dates back thousands of years, where they will have sculptures and then they'll have copies of those sculptures and they are clear fakes or, you know, counterfeits or honor type things, copies. From a purely economic standpoint, we've talked about this in the past, how counterfeiting seeks to actually, you know, improves the brand. People recognize that, well, if people are even counterfeiting this, then it must be really good. And it works as sort of a free advertising for that brand. And so, yes, for every time someone buys a cheap bottle of Lafite and drinks it and goes, oh, what is this garbage? This is obviously fake. I got hornswoggled. They recognize that the actual Lafite is something probably outside of their price range, or that it's actually something quite amazing to behold or to taste. So yeah, the benefits of, did Walter Block go do a thing in defense of counterfeiters?
Yeah. In defending the undefendable. I can look up the particular article defending the counterfeiter and post it on our show notes page. It is a pretty interesting take. All of his takes are pretty interesting and they run counter to what you would normally think. Walter Block is an interesting thinker.
Indeed.
Yeah. So I wanted to take off on that just a little bit. I think that there was one counterfeiter who was so good that the brand actually sought them out to become their new manufacturer. And that's real fuzzy in my head, but I'm sure there's an article about it from maybe 5-10 years ago. So I'll try to find that and put that on the show notes page as well.
By the way, there's another documentary called Sour Grapes that is specifically about counterfeit wine and a big kerfuffle that happened in the wine auction world, where a lot of people who bought what they thought was high-end wine was actually relabeled kind of cheaper wine. So that might be one to check out one day if you want to like get into the counterfeit wine kind of subject.
Like that is an interesting aspect of it, right? I mean, this is a product that you can't necessarily inspect the quality of until you have opened it and tasted it or smelled it or whatever, until you've basically devalued it massively, right?
To the bullshit element, like if you give a sommelier or master sommelier a bottle of counterfeit wine that has an 82 Lafite label on it, he might go through the whole swirling and sniffing and tasting process and decide that it's like it's among the best wines he's ever had, just because he knows he's drinking a wine from a bottle that has that Lafite label, that 82 Lafite label, and he doesn't want to look like a fool. So, but ultimately, if he finds out that he drank a counterfeit bottle, he's going to look like a bigger fool. So there is a grand level of bullshit to wine tasting and that kind of, I mean, one of the biggest drivers of California, the way California wine is made, is Robert Parker, who is who founded Wine Advocate magazine. He's a lawyer, but he likes, in the 70s, he, you know, just really liked wine and he wanted to start this wine magazine. But his tastes are big, bold reds, and you know, he would give the big bold reds a high rating. So and those wines with high ratings would sell. So the California winemakers would tailor their style of winemaking to make them bigger and bolder and more alcoholic, and just anything to please Robert Parker, regardless of whether, you know, the winemaker had a particular passion for a particular style of wine, whether it was low alcohol or less fruit or a little drier or a little more acidic. Robert Parker was the main driver of how California wines were made. So it really is kind of like the free market at work. I mean, you could say Robert Parker acted as like kind of like a dictator in wine, but it really was the market responding to whatever the masses were responding to themselves. If everybody was hanging on Robert Parker's every word, then the winemakers wanted to make sure that they were tailoring their wines to whatever the masses were going to appreciate based on what Robert Parker said. So it is a lot of bullshit, but if you start to taste a lot of wines and you start to differentiate what makes a good wine versus a bad wine, then you don't really care about those numbers like 93 rating or 90 rating or whatever. You just start to just differentiate what makes a good wine and what suits your taste. Like, not even what is a good wine. It's just what suits your taste. And nobody's going to, if you love Cavit, if you love Mondavi, if you like Woodbridge, you know, like, good, God bless you, you know. But if you want to explore more, if you want to get into Burgundies, into Volnays, into Bordeaux, whatever, the world's opening up to winemaking. There's a lot of new world winemakers that you can explore, and a lot of my favorite Pinot Noirs or Cabernet Sauvignons or Malbecs are come from South America. So it's not just French. It's a whole world opening up to winemaking.
Yeah. Now, when you were talking about the sommeliers, perhaps through ego or hubris, yep, or perhaps being paid off, and we also talked about the critics, perhaps being a vector of being able to be paid off to influence the prices. It reminds me of the Payola scandal, where DJs would be paid by the record labels to promote specific albums and songs to be played on the radio, I think in the 50s or 60s, and it became this big scandal. And it's almost, you know, they might have actually liked the songs, but because there was pay to play kind of going on, it sort of tainted it, and it almost amounts to a bit of a fraud, sort of like related to counterfeiting. If it's an homage, or if somebody knowingly buys something and they know that it's not authentic, but they still buy it anyway because they like the look of it or whatever, that's a different thing than buying the thing thinking it's the genuine article and being defrauded and it not being the genuine article.
I dated a girl in the early 2000s. We would go to New York City sometimes, and she would specifically buy knockoff Louis Vuitton handbags.
Knowingly.
She knew were fake, but she wanted the Louis Vuitton logo, and she didn't really give a crap if it was fake or not.
Right. And I always see the argument from brands who complain about that, saying, well, you're taking the cachet of our brand and that's resulting in lost sales. I kind of disagree. That person was never going to buy the genuine article for $800, whatever. You know, they're buying the $30 one that they find on Sixth Avenue.
And they're carrying around the logo for people who probably can't afford it, you know?
Right. Free advertising.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the Walter Blockian arguments, right? When somebody promotes something that's not theirs, even if they promote it as if they had made it, then you're still getting the awareness out there. You're sort of like freely marketing it, though. That does seem a bit fraudulent to misrepresent that, hey, I made this, when in fact you did not.
Yeah.
But in the case of a counterfeiter, though, they actually did make it. And if we are not, you know, for intellectual property, then shouldn't we be completely in support of the counterfeiter?
Even not if they're misrepresenting it. They're making the knockoff.
But are they actually saying that, hey, this is a legitimate actual Louis Vuitton bag? Or this is a bag and I put the Louis Vuitton logo on it.
There's two distinct kind of systems here. There's the one where they knowingly make something that everyone knows isn't real, right?
Right.
That's okay in my mind. The other one where they're emptying a genuine Lafitte bottle and dumping my box wine in there and recapping it and saying, here's Lafitte. That's fraudulent.
Yes.
Let me tell you, if you think you're getting a genuine Louis Vuitton bag from a Jamaican guy on the street in New York City for $30,
yeah,
that's on you, man.
It pretty much is, isn't it, though? That's got to be on the buyer.
Yeah.
Buyer beware.
I got a bridge to sell you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But the fraudulent, where you're misrepresenting something as the genuine article and trying to sell it at that high price, or
if you made this Louis Vuitton bag and you sold it on Sixth Avenue for $3,000 or whatever, it's still kind of on the person to go, why isn't this in the Louis Vuitton store?
Right.
But I get your point. Like, yeah.
And there might be some people in this example, in the wine example, who would buy a bottle of wine they knew was not 82 Lafitte, but had the label on it just so they could put it on their rack and show their friends who came over, like, hey, I got an 82 Lafitte here. You know, you can never taste it because it's too valuable to open right now. And so people will never know. But I could totally see that as far as having a counterfeit product that's merely on your shelf for a status symbol.
Right. Because
it's gotta be the best thing to counterfeit, right? Yeah, like the most valuable wine, because it'll never get opened and you'll never get found out.
I used to work for QVC, and we used to sell a line of jewelry called Diamondique, and they were like really brilliant stones that looked fabulous, but they weren't real diamonds, but they were something that the QVC buyer could afford, and it made them feel glamorous. It made them feel like high end. It made them feel like
nobody thought
among their friends. Yeah.
But nobody thought, oh, this is a $10,000 diamond. They knew it was a $200 Diamondique. Derelict.
Now, maybe if they lived in a trailer park, their neighbors saw them with this big rock on their hand. They probably didn't think, like, oh, you suddenly hit the lottery and you're still living in this piece of shit trailer park. But
though I have seen that, too, where people have a nice car and a shitty trailer park house.
Well, those are drug dealers.
But that's also one of those status symbol things, right? And
exactly.
And with even with the genuine article of Lafitte, I mean, those are selling for $10,000 a bottle or whatever the numbers were. So yeah, it totally makes sense that somebody would be willing to knowingly buy a knockoff Lafitte or an emptied one that they put, you know, my box wine in for $500 to put it on the shelf to impress their friends, because that's what the rich guys are doing. Why can't I, you know, get a little bit of status from a similar kind of setup?
Right.
And what did you guys think of the concerns of the chateau owners with the possibility of pricing out their customer base with their increased wine prices? It seemed to me that they were worried about having like too much stock and not being able to move it, because, and then like maybe the world moving on to a new taste or something like that. Maybe people lost their, you know, like lost their taste for Bordeaux wines, or it was just way too expensive, and that, you know, they required more of this kind of like, I don't know, middle-class purchasing as opposed to maybe all the high-end buyers that are only going to buy so much of it. I don't know. The movie seemed to make a big deal out of potentially pricing their customers out of the market, but it seemed like they would all balance out economically. I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I would think it would balance out because the market would clear at the lower prices over time, eventually.
Even if you had to move, even if you had to move your inventory at a lower price, I mean, you're still making some money. You're still staying afloat. And then hopefully, you know, you'll have good years in the future, or I don't know.
Right.
What were you gonna say?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the free market at work, and you know, I'm sure there are plenty of products that you know, let's just say like the VCR. You know, I mean, you could keep making VCRs as long as you wanted, but you know, when people started moving on to DVDs and Blu-rays, then you either had to realize that you were putting your resources into something that people didn't want anymore. Or, you know, you had to adjust to the market. So I think when something like if you have like a Bordeaux wine, if you're a Chateau who's been selling Bordeaux wine for however many years at a very high end price, then if the market starts to go down, then you have to adjust your harvest, your planning, your winemaking accordingly. And that's not to say that you can't have another vintage like you had in 2009 or 2010, where expectations are very high, the critics are very hot on it, and then you're right back in it. So it's all a matter of, I think this is why we don't want governments coming in and fixing prices, or because if the French government came in and fixed the price of a Bordeaux wine for a vintage that wasn't good, or for several vintages that weren't good, then you're getting lower quality of wine, but still paying the high end price. And that's just counterproductive to the kind of quality that customers want and deserve. So I think it's a great free market mechanism to have Bordeaux's that aren't performing as well sell at a lower price.
Let's say, for example, like the movie kind of made the Chinese market out to be the saviors of Bordeaux wine. Like they lost the American market, but then, oh, here comes the Chinese market on like gangbusters. We're able to market ourselves very well. There's a high demand, especially among this new nouveau riche Chinese area. But let's say that China is still stuck in the Cultural Revolution and nobody else is interested in Bordeaux wine. The economy in the United States collapses in 2008. They lose that massive market, which the United States used to be the number one buyer, as I think the movie said. Mm-hmm. So then they lose that. But there's still there's still this relationship between the critics setting the price. Now, I didn't quite follow, or the movie wasn't quite specific in that the critics actually came along and they would rate it. Right, like this is a 90 or a 95 or whatever. But then did the chateau owners come in and say, okay, a 95 is going to equal to $500 a bottle, a 90 is going to equal to $400 a bottle? Did they do that, or did the critics come in and set that, or how did that work?
I think that that's the situation, is that the critics would give a score, and then the chateaus would say, okay, we think that the high scores for this good vintage year are going to yield this price, so we're going to come up with this high price and so on. So I think it was a combination of the critics' score, and then the chateau would translate that score into a price that they would try to market it at.
Okay, so the chateau owners are still, they weren't like reliant or bound by some agreement with the critics. They could freely set the price to be like $5 a bottle if they wanted to.
I would think
even if it was 100.
Right. Okay. So like, let's say the Chinese market didn't open up like your scenario, the US market dries up for a while. Well, there's a market clearing price. I'm sure that there's still some demand at some price. And so they would just have to lower that price to find the buyers.
Right.
Well, I think, yeah, I think that the reason that the American market dried up for the Bordeaux is simply because of the Chinese. It's sort of like if you bought T-bone steaks from your local grocer because you were, you know, very well to do, and then your neighbor again hits the lottery, and he starts buying up all the T-bone steaks. Well, you start looking for other cuts of meat, and you let your neighbor just buy up all the T-bone steaks, and I think that's
at the new higher price.
Yeah, at the new higher price, and this is exactly what happened. It's just like it's not the Americans didn't like Bordeaux anymore. It's just that they, you know, the Chinese inflated the price to a level where American buyers, who are probably more to the the financial crisis obviously played a part in this, to the point where they started looking for alternatives. And like, you know, I said before, you know, there are a lot of quality wines coming out of South America, South Africa, all these different New World regions that don't necessarily rely on the Grand Cru kind of rating that you expect. I mean, you can get very, very, very good wine at, you know, a very reasonable price. Even in Bordeaux, you were talking about Grand Cru, which is a very highly rated wine and automatically carries with it a high price. So, I mean, I've bought Bordeaux's for $20 or $15. You know, they're technically less quality, but you know, you can still get a Bordeaux. I mean, all Bordeaux is a combination of Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot. So it's that style. It's not necessarily the quality you're looking for, but it's that style. It's that preference to whatever you're eating. It's all subjective. It is an all subjective value.
Is it similar? Is it similar, John, in that they can call it a Bordeaux style unless it's actually from Bordeaux, sort of like Champagne is a region of France. So officially only Champagne can come from Champagne, and anything else is a sparkling wine or whatever. Is Bordeaux sort of similar in that regard?
Exactly. There are plenty of California wines that are made in the Bordeaux style, meaning that they're blended with Cabernet and Merlot, but that you can't call them Bordeaux because they're not from the Bordeaux region. So it's all a matter of semantics in many ways, but you can get very quality wines that are made in the exact same style, but
Okay. Well, so we're over an hour already, so we should probably actually get into some final summary and review and give this our own wine enthusiast score. I guess it's a scale out of 100, so I guess we would need to go with that for this one, unless either of you have any final notes before we do that.
Not really. I think we covered most of it. Yeah, I mean, it would be really interesting to see if now that, you know, it's funny because, you know, we have the Chinese virus that's plagued the world, you know, and are the Chinese back in their dominant position in the sense that, you know, I see Wuhan, like they have those public pools that have like 3,000 people floating in them. Are they back to life, and are they back to buying Bordeaux wines, or have they moved on to a new region in the world? Maybe not necessarily France, but you know, whatever, South America, California, are they buying up wine somewhere else?
Yeah, I don't know. I do recall that Wuhan opened up again and had nightclubs and things going on, but I want to say that was about a year ago. And surprisingly, I've seen hardly anything about it since, other than discussions of a certain lab maybe being funded, maybe not, maybe leaking, maybe not. But all talk of like the effects on the ground in China and the Wuhan area, I'm almost oblivious to in the past year.
Yeah, I'm sure it's all the up and up.
Sure, you're right. All right, Robert, why don't you lead us off and give us your sommelier rating out of 100 points possible.
Okay, so Red Obsession. Is it worth watching in 2021, this ancient film from 2013? Yeah, I think so. If you have any kind of interest in wine or economics, or if you're just interested in the history, it's very much plays out kind of like a history. It teaches you a little bit about the wine industry, stuff I certainly did not know. I didn't know about the, I certainly was aware of the vast wealth being generated in China. And I was been cheering that on for quite some time. I didn't know that they were getting into wine, but it would make sense that, like our guest was saying, that if you've got a whole bunch of disposable income, you might start taking an interest in the finer things in life. That's not true of the vast majority of Chinese quite yet, but their level of wealth keeps rising and rising and rising. So I think at one point the movie, so that was in 2012, 2013 at time, they were talking about the average consumption in China was one bottle a year for China. Whereas in the United States, it was like 20 or 30 or something like that. 35, I don't remember what it was, but hopefully that will continue to trend upwards. Not that I give a shit about the wine industry. It's a perfectly fine beverage, but I don't know if I'll ever be one of those people. Not that I look down on them in any way. You find what you like in this world and you go for it. I think if you find some joy in wine, man, all more power to you. That's fantastic. I really enjoyed seeing the entrepreneurial spirit of the Chinese that they depicted in this film. Of course, there's probably a bunch of fascistic issues. It's not a completely free market. You speak out against the Chinese government, it's a nightmare. They are a totalitarian bag of dicks. Let's put it that way. But the film Red Obsession starts off pretty dry. Wine reference. And then it gets a little bit meaty. Thank you, Daniel. that it gets a little bit meaty. And I start actually getting into some interesting story. So
hints of apricot and a nice finish.
Yeah, it definitely has a nice finish to it. Definitely finishes strong on the palate. So I am going to give this one. I don't think it's a fantastic film. It's nice and short, which I appreciated. It didn't stick around too long. Didn't overstay its welcome. And it was interesting and it did teach me something. So for that, I have to give it a positive review for sure. But I don't think it's like it's not, you know, an amazing documentary or anything. It's not revealing, you know, anything particularly juicy other than grapes. So I will give this one I don't know, what's a bad rating for a wine? Do they even go into the sub 50s? Can you get like a 20 wine and then that sells for like a few dollars? I don't even know. I think they not even bother selling 80, it at that point.
You're talking about a bad wine. 80.
Low 80s. Okay.
Low 80s. That's a bad wine?
Yeah.
Well, then this is going to be a really, really bad wine.
But you still recommend it.
It's a decent movie. So I'm going to give this one a 73. Yeah, that's a pretty dang good movie, but it's a bad, bad wine.
Okay. All right, Robert. Well, that's not too bad. That's better than I was expecting out of you, especially when I was watching this. I was like, oh, no. Robert hates musicals, but man, following up a musical with a documentary about wine.
But, yeah, I mean, usually documentaries are all about the subject matter, and I do enjoy a good doc, but it's got to have good subject matter, and I thought that this was going to be a little bit too dry, too nothing to see here. But then they did kind of change it around with the Chinese angle. So I appreciated that. Cause I was ignorant of all that.
All right, cool. So 73. So I'll get underway here. So I'm going to say that Red Obsession has notes of dark fruits, plum, chocolate, and vanilla. And it's grown in a nice climate. In a region that boasts a need for sunglasses by day and fleece jackets by night. It's a great wine at a great price. I thought that having Russell Crowe's narration was pretty good. I've seen a Facebook post a while back where it said, if you could have anyone except for Morgan Freeman narrate your life, who would it be? And now that I've seen this movie, I think maybe Russell Crowe would be a good candidate for that. I found it informative. I thought that the history side of it was the most interesting. For me, just learning about the region and Napoleon's influence and how it goes back to Roman times. And they're sort of harkening back on that history as a reason for why it's going to weather any storm and stick around. And that's why they're willing to sort of continue on in spite of perhaps this additional competition from China, copying a lot of the things that they're doing. They think that they're going to be resilient because they have that history to lean on. And so that also kind of plays into subjective value a bit and the entrepreneurial spirit. So I thought that this was really well done and interesting. I learned a lot. And I appreciate, John, for you bringing this up because it gave us plenty of things to discuss and get into some economic angles and some sort of advanced supply and demand pricing theorizing, which I think I still need to do some thinking through. But I'm going to give this an 82, just because that's a good year for Lafitte, gangster style. So, John, what's your take and final score, sir?
Yeah, so I'm going to look at this through the lens of somebody who's not into wine. I think it's a very good movie as far as, like, to everybody's point, it's very educational. If you don't know anything about wine, the wine world, then you learn a lot in this movie. I think it's to me, someone like me, it's very, you know, interesting. I actually saw this movie once, and this is actually the only second time I've seen it when I knew I was doing this. So I love this kind of film. Personally, I would have given an 80, but I'm just going to take my own personal prejudices out of it, and I'm going to give it a 70. I think it's an okay documentary, and I think it's a really interesting subject to me, and I think it's really well done, but I can see how a lot of people might be turned off by it, so I'm going to give it a 70. And I think the one element that we missed in all this, if you remember the part where they tie in like the wine industry, the French wine industry, with the Chinese beauty pageant, you remember that part? If you remember that one girl with the dark eyes and the dark hair, totally hot. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, like, she was totally worth it, like, that girl.
So you're going to give her a high score?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, the dark hair, dark eyes girl, like...
Okay. See, I thought you were going to go low pan style, the girl with the green eyes. Bring me the girl with green eyes.
Yeah, was there a girl with green eyes in this film?
I don't think so. I have no idea.
Dark hair, dark eyes. She was totally hot. Yeah, like, she's worth it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that, John. We'll be sure to edit this portion out so your fiance doesn't hear that. But, you know, if she does hear it and doesn't mind, you might have found a winner. So good job. Well done, sir. Congratulations.
I will own her soon. It matters not what she thinks.
So we're going to use the alternate definition of husbandry.
Exactly. She will speak when spoken to.
All right. You're going to get to talking to later, I'm sure. All right. Well, this was a lot of fun, and I appreciate the humor at the end here because it's very reminiscent of a recent passing, and that is, of course, the great Norm MacDonald, one of the goats of all time. He died of cancer on Tuesday of this past week, and it's one of those things where apparently he was suffering from this for 9 years, and I don't think he told anyone. So that is pretty wild, and I'm a bit shaken up by it because I really enjoy his work, and so we're going to, in honor of him, do a movie, one of his best movies. And that, of course, is Dirty Work. And we're going to have Raylene Lightheart on for that one. We also have Raylene lined up for The Goonies the following week. So it's going to be back to back. We're doing Women's Equality Month for the month of September because, you know, we got to make it equal on all sides here. So she's going to be on back to back, number one for Dirty Work and then The Goonies.
A Lightheart extravaganza. Fantastic.
Yeah, and perhaps we can get her husband to join. He was on with us for Contagion way, way back early on in the Chinese virus days.
That's right. Yes.
I think we held ourselves pretty well with very limited information at the time. I might give that another listen and just see how our discussion holds up to what we've learned since.
You probably said at some point, I can't wait till this 15 days is over.
I think it was before the 15 days was even a thing. I think we did that at the end of February.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. March sometime. Yeah.
You were like ground zero at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. It was still just being talked about in China. And they were talking about like people being locked in buildings and not being able to get out and all these like cell phone signatures, like just disappearing. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing nefarious there. Anyway.
Nothing to see there for sure.
Anyway, we will be on for Dirty Work next week. So before that, check out John's stuff here. I'm going to get the scrolling going. Winewithbarbecue.com. Let's see. That's the bottom one there. There it is. Yeah. Winewithbarbecue.com. Find that. Yep. Scrolling along the bottom, inching along, and you find the show notes and more for this episode at lastnighters.com/195. If you want some pre-show and post-show bonus content, hit us up at our Patreon and send some love our way. And by love, I mean Federal Reserve notes. For as long as they're still worth anything, we will accept them in trade for additional bonus content. So, John, thanks again for being our guest. I hope you stick around for a little bit longer. I know it's late for you, but we will be back next week for the old Dirty Work, celebrating Norm MacDonald. And with that, we will say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right. All right. And a few more minutes on the Actual Anarchy podcast. Show notes and more for this one at actualanarchy.com/252. Robert, there's one other angle I wanted to talk to you about, and that was about what did you think was going to be the effect of the Chinese sort of identifying this newfound thing that can be made? Because it was very successful, made a lot of money in China, the Bordeaux stuff coming in from France, that they emulated it, created their own thing, and then could then satiate that burgeoning domestic Chinese market that was destined to grow from one bottle per person on up. Does it strike you as a rap game style thing where they take this hook from Bordeaux and then make their own thing about it? Are they taking anything from Bordeaux to satisfy the new Chinese market with this new production that they develop domestically?
Are they taking anything from it? I'm not sure you're asking me. Like, are they like robbing Bordeaux of anything by emulating it? Is that what you're saying?
Right. I know that would be a very midwit take or a very school educated take.
Yeah. I love it. I think it's fantastic. There's a scene in the movie where this Chinese wine gets this award from the Decanter Society or whatever.
Yeah, totally unexpected.
Wine of the year.
Blows away all the others. Yeah.
And they're just like dumbfounded. They're just like, what? Well, how did these guys, I mean, I guess it was a blind taste test and they won the majority vote. So I guess they're the best. But they in the way they reacted, it seemed like they were very much stunned. Like they did not anticipate this. This is probably something that they always did well in year after year, or they expected to do very, very well with their awesome vintage that they had made that year or whatever. All that can do is inspire them to compete harder and do better. Sharing knowledge across people, across the world, all it does is elevate everybody else's game. The failures ought to fail. They do have that history to fall back on, but it seemed to me like that was kind of a lame, weak crutch that they were using. Like, yeah, we may not be very good, but we used to be. So check us out still for some reason. Whereas the Chinese are just like killing it and everybody's buying this Chinese wine and they're like, yeah, we don't have any history at all. We're the new kids on the block and we're destroying your market. So deal with it, compete with us or die. And yeah, I mean, I don't know how much the Chinese government was involved. They had that one scene where the Chinese government was inputting like what, 60, 30 million or 60 million into this area where they had to bury the plants in it at night over the winter in order to keep them alive.
Freeze. Yeah.
Right. But the other guy, there was another rich guy that built an entire chateau north of Beijing. He didn't talk about any kind of government funding at all. And maybe he was just some rich guy who really, really liked wine. I don't remember exactly or if the movie even told us that. But the Chinese struck me and the lady that they interviewed, the wine lady, I don't remember her name. She was talking about how the Chinese are very much connoisseurs of other cultures. Like they will taste and go around the world and sample all the fine things of the world. Like what does this culture do? What do they do really, really well? Maybe we could do that too.
They'd be appropriate. Yeah.
Like they go around. Yes, they culturally appropriate all the things, but they're kind of like this melting pot amalgamation, not of necessarily different peoples. They're all Chinese people, but they are adopting the best things of all the different cultures that they produce in the rest of the world and see if they can make a reasonable facsimile or even beat them at their own game. And I love that entrepreneurial spirit, that can-do attitude that, you know, we're the new kids on the block and we don't know anything about this, but we're smart and we're going to figure it out and we're going to analyze this and we're going to infuse our own artistic expression. Maybe that's one thing that they are kind of lacking is their own artistic expression. Like they're not so much great creators, but they are great copiers. Like you can tell them what you want them to make and they can make it really, really well, but they're not necessarily the Leonardo da Vinci's of whatever. They're not the great innovators perhaps yet, Maybe that's not, maybe that's a cultural thing. Maybe that's just something that they will get around to. Maybe that's something that they're doing right now, but we just don't know so much about it, or I don't know so much about it yet. But I'm excited, even with what they do do. Like, if they are not the great artists of the world, but they're just the great producers of the world, fantastic. More good for them. Fantastic. Maybe they'll be just, you know, they'll go around the world, you know, once a year and sample the best things that everybody's making. And then they'll take it home and then they'll mass produce that thing and sell it to everybody else in the world. That's a great niche, and they're doing a great job doing it.
Yeah. More quantity of higher quality goods for more people.
Makes everybody wealthier.
And I know this is wrong, but at less prices, we saw this car commercial, like local dealer commercial in California back in 2002, 2003, back when the Sacramento Kings had Chris Webber. It was the playoffs. And this commercial would come on and they say,
Webb,
we had less prices. They were, of course, trying to say lower prices. So it became part of my vernacular. Anyway, nice. John, let's get your commentary on this final question, and then we will wind down the show. You've been a great guest, by the way. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Yeah, I'm just going to piggyback on what Rob said. I think the problem with China is that, you know, it does have a rich history of being a very well-traveled, you know, traders from Europe would come, traders from all over Eurasia would come and just buy and sell goods in China for centuries and centuries. And then, you know, in the 20th century, we had that little thing called, you know, the Communist Party, and a few generations lived under extreme poverty and lived under just, you know, fear of daily fear of death. And then when Mao Zedong died and the markets started opening up, you saw, you know, in the movie, they had that sped up video of Shanghai, just like the skyscrapers going up and everything. And I think, to Rob's point, when you have all these people suddenly trading like from all over the world in these particular areas, like people who have never known anything but poverty and just daily struggle, when they suddenly start to see these rich people coming in and trading goods and introducing them to a world that they've never known before, including wine, they're going to want to explore whatever it is that these wealthy Americans, wealthy Europeans, whatever, are suddenly into. You know, if I'm suddenly becoming wealthy, then I want to act like that wealthy person and I want to buy a lot of wine. So it's very much a status symbol, and they just want to emulate whatever it is that everybody else who they view as having high status are into. And I've never tried Chinese wine myself, so I can't say whether it's on a par I'm going to, since that tasting was blind that Steve Spurrier was involved in, I'm going to say that the quality of wine that won that award was excellent. So, but I have yet to try Chinese wine. So I'm actually really interested to taste the kind of quality that they're able to produce. But yeah, I mean, I think the sky's the limit for them. Unfortunately, they still live under a very constrained circumstance where they have this social credit system, and they always have like a surveillance state. Not that we don't, but they've kind of grown accustomed to it. They've grown up in it. So it's I'm sure it's just baked into the cake of their society where it's becoming an unpleasant reality for ours.
Right. And we may bristle against it, and hopefully that will yield some positive results. Yet to be seen, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But speaking of the Chinese wine, I haven't even considered or even heard of Chinese wine until watching this. And it's not like I, you know, go and buy anything other than these boxed wines, because my body is no longer tolerating beer. So that's why we have the wine as an alternate substitution. So I wonder if there even is like a section at the grocery store or the wine store of Chinese wines to even try, or if it's mostly produced domestically for domestic consumption in China.
Yeah, so, I've yet to see it in my wine shops here, so my guess would be that it's more for the Chinese people.
Right, yeah. But still, I mean, that's satisfying a market demand, and I'm sure that they're giving high quality at lower prices, thus raising the standard of living for the consuming public in their country. So wins all around. Well, thanks a lot, John. This has been a lot of fun. I'll, of course, have the show notes page with a link to your latest project, as well as your prior appearances, such as for Reds, Apocalypse Now. There's been a whole bunch, and I always blank when we, when we have you on.
I remember it.
But there's been like five or six. And
I think so, yeah.
I'd love to have you on again. Full Metal Jacket was one. That's right.
Full Metal Jacket, that's right.
Yeah, that was a really good one.
Yeah.
So we will of course have you on again in the near future, and hopefully at some point for Deliverance, because I want to hear you squeal like a pig, boy.
Looking forward to that.
All right. Well, thanks again, everyone, and we'll be back next week for a remembrance of the great Norm Macdonald with Raylene Lightheart as we discuss Dirty Work. And you find the show notes more for this episode at actualamerica.com/252. Find our guest work at winewithbarbecue.com. And with that, we'll say maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out and have a good night. Bye.
The Chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the Chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.